I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke. Okay, so Emma, give me your true crime chat this week. What have you been up to?
I finally caught up on Unsolved Mysteries. And yeah, it's amazing. I love it so much. I'm so excited. I hope they keep doing more and more series.
Yeah, I mean, I got a little bit excited prematurely the other day because it came up saying new episodes and I was like, yes! And I went in and I was like, oh no, those are the ones I've already watched.
Oh no, that's rubbish.
No. So that was quite disappointing. But so yeah, tell me what you thought about it generally, because I think we should probably do a special episode just to discuss Unsolved Mysteries because there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, I really like the format and I feel like they've brought it right up to date. They've done it in a really good way when they revisit the cases and, you know, they do the information and things like with the one with the little boys that were stolen. You know how at the end they showed the age progressions and pictures of their missing children. So whilst it does feel like a, I don't know, like obviously it's meant to be interesting and fun to watch, but you do feel like they are actually reaching out as well, which is what the original Unsolved Mysteries was as well. So I didn't know when they redid it if it was just going to be a bit more dramatised and it was not really actually to, you know, put the plight of the cases into the public eye. But I really do feel like they have aimed for that. Yeah.
One thing that I didn't remember from the old Unsolved Mysteries was that they, you know, they occasionally had these unexplained episodes like psychic or paranormal
stuff.
And I kind of hope that might not feature this time around, because I was like, to me I'm just a bit like, whatever. But it seems like they are still going in the same format.
It's kind of a guilty pleasure for me, that kind of thing. Like, I really would love for those like paranormal things and UFOs and all that, I would love for them to be true. I really would. But I'm very pragmatic and scientific, and it just, it's so annoying. But in my mind, it's kind of just enjoyable to think about, a bit like when I read like fantasy and sci-fi novels. I just let my brain take a bit of a rest and imagine the ritual. Do you know what I mean? The ones that I found really interesting, and I've always found this really interesting, is the reincarnation stories and the ones where it's a small child that couldn't know that that's even a thing. Do you know what I mean? And then they come forward with these stories. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I believe happens after you pass away, but you've got to wonder, if there is a soul, does it go somewhere? So
I think it gives you hope.
It does, yeah, it does. And I think
that's the nice thing about it. It gives you hope that there's more. There's mm-hmm. more beyond, you know, what we know.
The weird ones is when someone, you know, a kid dies and then their sibling gets born and they seem to think that they're the sibling. Do you know what I mean? Like, they remember, they're like, oh, I was here before, you were still my mum and daddy, but then I got ill and went to hospital, and you're like, oh, it's so weird, really weird. But yeah, I don't know. I kind of would love that sort of thing to be real. Alien abductions, I'm less convinced by.
That's good to know.
Watch me get abducted now and have to Oh, but I don't know, that I feel like with some supernatural stuff, I can understand that maybe there is a plane of existence that we can't see or hear. Like, maybe we don't have the senses available to view them or see them. Like, you know, when they talk about how aliens could probably do exist out there, they might not use any of the same senses that we do. They might see things totally differently. They might not have vision. It might be, you know what I mean? There could be so many different ways. So maybe it's not that it's supernatural. It's just different to the biology and laws of physics that we know.
Yeah, I do think there are sort of limitations to our brains and what we can actually conceive.
Yeah, totally.
If you know what I mean. Yeah. And I remember, like, Sean said, he told me something that kind of along those lines. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like infinity times infinity, da da da. And I was like, no, my brain can't deal with that. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So, I agree with you in that regard.
But then again, that's still me having the science brain going, well, maybe those are things, but they're just not supernatural.
Yeah. It's just inconceivable to our tiny little minds.
Exactly. To be fair, in the past couple of hundred years, our knowledge of the world and how everything works has exponentially grown.
Yeah.
So who's to say that in another 100 years we might know so much more and think that we were basically Neanderthals that didn't know anything?
Yeah.
You don't know.
Yeah. I mean, not that I want to get too into this conversation, but I do find it surprising that out of the amount of time that we've existed on this planet, how much, like you say, has actually become known just in the past 100 years. Yeah.
What were we doing?
I know, exactly.
Faffing about farming potatoes.
Yeah. That's all we were
faffing
doing.
Faffing about farming potatoes.
Nothing of value.
That's all we were doing. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. Sorry, ancestors.
Yeah.
You're wasting my time here. So, what case have you got for me today?
All right, okay. So, you're going to have to buckle in today. It's going to be a long one.
Okay, I'm ready.
So, I have yet again gone rogue.
Always.
However, I feel it's justified because it's topical.
Okay. If there's someone in this case called Mary, I will lose my mind.
There may be a Mary.
Of course there's a Mary.
I felt like I had to cover the case of the Yorkshire Ripper.
Mm.
Because he died last week and it's really topical at the moment, and I thought it made sense to do an episode on him.
Our listeners will definitely be interested in hearing about him. If they don't know anything already, then this is a really good episode for them.
Try and reserve any questions to the end, because otherwise it might just make this really, really long. I'm gonna try and keep it concise and just get through it.
I will.
Yeah, if you still have questions at the end, we'll see how we go if I haven't already answered them. Okay.
The murder of Jacqueline de Wallaby is a tragedy that has puzzled and polarised the minds of those who know it. Over the past 6 months, we've extensively investigated this case, trawling through files, trial transcripts and archives, and have been conducting interviews with the people who've lived through it.
It was a sensational, startling fact that a 7-year-old little girl had shown up missing from a suburban home.
Something like that happening would have never crossed our parents' minds.
The notion that a stranger can slip into a child's bedroom in the middle of the night, completely undetected, is surely a notion that every single parent on this earth fears. But what's even more lamentable is knowing that a child killer is roaming the street, and even more chilling, they could be someone you know.
Hosted by Emily G. Thompson and Eileen McFarlane, this is The Shattered Window.
In the 1970s, the biggest manhunt in British criminal history took place in the north of England. Yorkshire is the largest county in the United Kingdom and is formally known as the County of York. The population in 2011 was just shy of 5.3 million. Yorkshire's largest city is Leeds, which has a significant financial sector. Bradford, Halifax, Keighley and Huddersfield once were centres of wool milling. Areas such as Bradford, Dewsbury and Keighley have suffered a decline in their economy since. North Yorkshire has an established tourist industry supported by the presence of two national parks, the Yorkshire Dales National Park and the North York Moors National Park. Coal mining was extremely active in the south of the county during the 19th century and for most of the 20th century, particularly around Barnsley and Wakefield. As late as the 1970s, the number of miners working in the area was still in six figures. The industry was placed under threat on the 6th of March 1984 when the National Coal Board announced the closure of 20 pits nationwide, some of them in South Yorkshire. Since then, the number of open pits has declined. There are 12 universities across Yorkshire, and if you needed any other information about Yorkshire, it is also where Downton Abbey is set. That's my favourite thing about you. No. Downton Abbey isn't filmed there, it's filmed in Berkshire at Highclere Castle, but it is set in Yorkshire. So that's just a bit of background about Yorkshire and, you know, the north of England, just to give our listeners a bit of context, because not everyone that listens to our podcast is in the UK.
Okay, so on the 5th of July 1975, Anna Rogulski was 42 years old and she was walking home in Keighley when she was struck from behind with a blow to the head. Anna sustained a total of 3 blows to the head with a hammer and slashed across the stomach with a knife. Her attacker was disturbed by a neighbour and she was found around an hour later, barely alive. Her attack baffled police as it appeared the crime did not have a motive of sexual assault or robbery. On 15th of August 1975, 46-year-old Olive Smelt was a wife and mother of two who was attacked by a blow to the back of the head with a hammer. As she fell, she was hit again and slashed on her back with a knife. Her attacker was disturbed by an approaching car and fled the scene. Olive Smelt survived the attack, however, it had a devastating effect on her quality of life after the fact. On the 27th of August 1975, 14-year-old Tracy Brown and her twin sister Mandy had gone for a night out in the town of Silsden, close to where they lived. Before making the journey home to the farm they lived on, Tracy stopped to say goodbye to some friends. Mandy started the walk home, leaving Tracy behind. Approximately a mile away from home, Tracy stopped to remove her shoes. She noticed a man had appeared and continued walking with her. Tracy was subsequently attacked with a hammer just short of her home, taking 5 blows to the head. A passing car spooked her attacker, who threw her over a fence and fled. Tracy survived the attack, and though her attacker wasn't charged with the assault, he confessed to it in 1992. The description Tracy subsequently gave of her attacker was incredibly accurate, and she was able to recall many details of the attack, despite undergoing 4 hours of surgery to remove shards of bone from her head.
In October 1975, Wilma McCann, a 28-year-old mother of 4, originally from Scotland and working as a sex worker, was attacked in the Prince Philip playing fields in Leeds, which is in Yorkshire. She was a stone's throw from her house and had been hit over the head and stabbed 14 times. Her clothing had been disturbed, her top had been pulled up, and her trousers had been pulled down. She was murdered. Okay, so that was October 1975. In January 1976, a 42-year-old mother of 3 working as a sex worker named Emily Jackson got into a car with a man promising to pay her for sex. She was driven to abandoned wasteland, hit in the head with a hammer, and stabbed 51 times with a screwdriver. There was a boot print left on her leg at the crime scene. As both women were sex workers, the motive was assumed to be hatred of sex workers, and thus any attacks on women who weren't sex workers was dismissed. Descriptions had been given of a bearded attacker in Wakefield in 1972, Bradford and Keighley in 1975, and Leeds in 1976. So these are all attacks that happened previously, during and after these two murders, but they were disregarded. In May 1976, a woman named Marcella Claxton was leaving a party and accepted a lift from a stranger. She was 20 years old. She was driven to Roundhay Park in Leeds and hit in the head with a hammer. She was left for dead, but she survived. When she came around, she managed to make her way to a phone box and call the police. Marcella was 4 months pregnant at the time of the attack and lost her baby as a result. The EFIT that was produced following Marcella's attack wasn't included in the search for the Yorkshire Ripper, as he had been dubbed, as she wasn't a sex worker and wasn't attacked with a knife. So her attack was discounted. In February 1977, Irene Richardson was a 28-year-old mother of three working as a sex worker. She was also taken to Roundhay Park by a man willing to pay her for sex. She was hit in the head three times with a hammer and stabbed in the stomach, neck and throat. Her body was arranged by the killer and tire tracks were left at the scene. 9 months were spent trying to trace the tires which had left the tracks before the search was abandoned. Peter Sutcliffe's details were on the remaining list to be checked when it was abandoned. In April 1977, Patricia Atkinson was a 32-year-old woman working as a sex worker who got into a car with a man outside the Carlisle pub in Bradford. She took him to her home where he attacked her with a hammer just inside the front door. A bloody footprint was left at the scene, which showed the attacker was wearing a size 7 Wellington boot. In June 1977, Jane McDonald was a 16-year-old shop assistant. She was attacked at a children's playground in Leeds. Jane had been hit in the head with a hammer, dragged face down and stabbed in the chest and back. She was not a sex worker. As I say, she was working as a shop assistant. Her body was found by two children the following day. It seems that the attack on Jane made the public sit up and realise it was not just sex workers that were at risk of being attacked. And it also seems to be the case that struck the nation the hardest at that point, because she was young, she was pretty, she was working in a shop.
And once again, we see the bias against sex workers here coming to the fore.
Yep, absolutely. And remember, this was in the 70s as well, so that was much more pronounced than I would say it would be today. So this case is the one that made the public sit up and sort of take note. And actually, it was at this point that the moniker the Yorkshire Ripper was given. And, you know, they realised at this point that it wasn't just sex workers, that other women were at risk here as well.
On the 5th of July 1977, Maureen Long was 42 years old and had been enjoying a night out at the local pubs, finishing her evening at a disco. Upon leaving in the wee hours of the morning, she accepted a lift from a stranger. While stopped in a desolate area, Maureen squatted near the car to relieve herself. She was struck on the back of her head with a hammer and dragged to an area close by. She was stabbed multiple times until a night watchman was alerted to the attack due to his dog barking. Her attacker took off at high speed, with the witness misidentifying the car as a Ford Cortina. It was in fact a Ford Corsair. Maureen survived the attack.
Between the 30th of September and the 11th of October 1977, Jean Jordan was attacked. She was a 21-year-old mother of two working as a sex worker. She was picked up in Mossside, Manchester and taken to Wasteground. She was attacked and killed. She lay undiscovered for 10 days and it is known that her killer revisited the body and attempted to decapitate her with a hacksaw but was unsuccessful. Tire marks were also found at the scene. The killer had paid Jean with a brand new £5 note, which was traceable. Police believe the killer revisited the body to find the new £5 note, but was unlucky. A passerby discovered Jean's discarded handbag and handed it in. Amazingly, the £5 was still inside and allowed police to work on tracing it. So just to point that out, somebody come across her discarded handbag. Now, my experience is that maybe I'm cynical, but I feel that most people that come across lost property, if there's any cash, they would pocket it. You know, maybe cards and things would be handed in, but cash, it's not typically handed in, but in this case it was. So that was...
It's just sheer luck that the right person found it then, really.
Absolutely. And back then as well, £5 would have been a lot more than what it would be for us today.
It's yeah. a lot. Yeah.
So the note was traced back to a batch of £25,000 which had gone to the Midland Bank in Shipley, Bradford, from the Bank of England. 2 weeks later, the police established that the £5 note given to Jean Jordan had gone to one of 34 firms in a pay packet, but the firms had a total of 8,000 employees combined. Peter Sutcliffe was one of those employees. So just to inform any listeners that are younger, this is back in the times where your pay packet, it was typically paid weekly and it was the cash in a literal pay packet, which you then would take to the bank and deposit.
In fact, a lot of men would take it home and give it to the wife, and then the wife would do the breakdown for the budget and take the money for, you know, whatever. And it would, that was why like Friday night drinks became a thing, because then the guy would often take some of the money and go to the pub.
All right. It was cash anyway, which I've never experienced in my working life. It's always been fax payments straight into the bank account.
I might spend less of my wages on rubbish if I got it in literal cash and had to hand it over every time. They say that you spend less money if you do that.
So, as I say, they traced it to one of 34 firms that I'd gone to in a pay packet. But like I say, out of the 34 firms, they had a total combined employee count of 8,000. So that's a significant amount. Within weeks of Jean Jordan's death, police visited Peter Sutcliffe twice to interview him about the £5 note. He was alibied by both his wife and mother, who confirmed he had been at a housewarming party on the night of Jean's death. Peter and his wife had recently bought a house. In December 1977, Marilyn Moore was a 25-year-old sex worker who was taken to an area around 200 yards from the Prince Philip playing fields. As she went to get into the back seat of the car, the client that she was with, she found the rear passenger door locked. The attacker made his way around the car and hit her on the head with a hammer. But when he went to hit her on the head, he slipped in some mud and basically he just ended up giving her like a glancing blow. She started screaming. There was a nearby dog barking. He got spooked, jumped in the car, floored it. It wheel spinned for a bit and then he took off. So she actually survived. Unfortunately, Marilyn Moore incorrectly identified the car as a Morris Oxford, but it was a Ford Corsair. Three tyre marks at the scene were found to be an exact match to the earlier tracks at both Irene Richardson and Jean Jordan's crime scenes. Although Marilyn Moore provided a very close description of her attacker, she was felt to be an unreliable witness as she began accusing innocent men. Over 3 months, 5,000 men were questioned and the search for the £5 note stopped in January 1978 when police seemed unable to narrow the results down in regards to it. On the 31st of January 1978, Helen Ritka was an 18-year-old who had grown up in children's homes with her twin sister Rita. They both worked the same area in Huddersfield as sex workers. At Gunnard's Timber Yard, near some railway arches, Helen was hit on the head 5 times as she exited the car of her attacker and she'd been stabbed in the chest. She was reported missing by Rita and her body was found 3 days later. On the night that Helen died, Rita had reported seeing a brown van. Now, the man that drove this brown van was a client who had a kink about outdoor sex, and he'd followed Rita to watch her with a client. Now, because they were identical twins, if he had instead chosen to follow Helen instead of Rita 2 or 3 minutes later, he would have actually been an eyewitness to the murder. So he would have seen the whole thing. But he chose to follow Rita instead of Helen. Police received a letter claiming to be from the Ripper. It was postmarked in Sunderland and addressed to George Oldfield, who was the assistant chief constable. The letter warned whores to stay off the street, and it was believed to be genuine. The reason being that it corrected police on the number of victims. Police believed there to have been 7 deaths caused by the Ripper at that point, but he confirmed it as 8, saying, "Remember Preston 1975. This referred to a woman named Joan Harrison, who'd been murdered 3 weeks after the first victim. She was 26 years old and she'd been battered to death. She was also a sex worker, but as she'd not been attacked with a knife or a hammer, her death was not thought to be related to the Ripper and was instead thought to be motivated by robbery or sex. Joan Harrison had a bite mark on her breast." Over 15 months, the police received 4 letters claiming to be from the Ripper. None contained fingerprints, but 1 envelope had been licked. So they tested the DNA, and from that, it was found that the person who had licked the envelope had B-positive blood, which only 6% of the population had at that time. And that was consistent with the semen found at Joan Harrison's crime scene. So the person that wrote the letter was connected to Joan Harrison in Preston in 1975. So just remember that point.
Did the other crime scenes have any DNA evidence?
No.
Okay.
No. So DNA connects the letter with Joan Harrison, who hadn't been included. Between 20th of January and 26th of March 1978, at some point between those dates, Yvonne Pearson was killed. And it was believed that she was actually killed potentially in January 1978, but her body lay undiscovered until Easter Sunday in March 1978. She was a 21-year-old sex worker from Bradford. Her attacker had bludgeoned her in the head with a hammer, appeared to have jumped on her chest, and stuffed horsehair into her mouth from a nearby discarded sofa where he hid her body. Yvonne's skull was said to have been caved in, and it was deemed to have been the most brutal attack to date.
It's the fact for me, again, that these poor women are not even being reported missing in certain cases. You know, the fact that the bodies are lying undetected, but it's not like, oh, Yvonne went missing and was, you know, people were out looking for her. It's just, you know, she's lying discarded somewhere.
Yeah.
And that the fact that they can't even tell for sure exactly when. That's the second victim now that has like a range between, you know, the dates that they could have been murdered.
Detective Chief Superintendent Trevor Lapish didn't believe the letter to have been genuine, as he felt there would have been mention of Yvonne Pearson's murder. So at the time that her letter was received, her body was still lying undiscovered. You know, I get his point. If the person that was writing these letters was the genuine ripper, why didn't he tell police, oh, by the way, there's another one that you haven't yet found? If he was correcting them on the victim count?
Yeah, that makes sense. I know what you're saying. Yeah, but also, I don't know, there's something weird about it anyway, and I think back in the day, you know how they could only really do like the blood typing and things
like
that?
Yeah, blood group.
It's really hard to prove that they're linked anyway. So obviously they're looking at the psychology and how the attacks were carried out. But yeah, it's a weird one. I wouldn't have wanted to try and have to work out what ones were in and what weren't.
It definitely wasn't an easy investigation by any manner or means. They didn't have the technology that we have today. Everything was done manually. There was like 600,000 index cards. It was just pretty much nigh on impossible, to be honest, because the amount of data that had been collected and how could you imagine having to try and organize that huge amount of data and be able to go and pick a piece of that information out. Like, you know, we absolutely take things for granted having computers these days. Like this was before that time, so you know, it would have been very, very significant. 16th of May 1978, Vera Millward was a 41-year-old mother of seven. She was a poorly woman who only had one lung. She died in the grounds of Manchester Royal Infirmary and had been attacked. She had hammer wounds to her head and stab wounds to her body.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The wounds were found to follow a pattern, often with the same wound being punctured more than once. I mean, it's not that's not cruel anyway, but that's just a special kind of...
Must be agonising.
Yeah, exactly. So at this point, we were just talking about technology. The Police National Computer, so it wasn't even the Police National Database at the time, it was just Police National Computer. It had been created in 1974, so it was very much still in its infancy. This is 1978, and obviously it was not as extensive or advanced as it is today. But the Police National Computer was used to record the makes, models and registration numbers of cars seen around the red light districts. So they were recorded and entered into the computer. The information was then printed out on paper, and I imagine it probably would have been that, you know, that white paper that had the dots down either side? Probably would have been something like that, you know, streams and streams of it. Well, apparently, they lay it on the incident room floor and they would literally be on their hands and knees and screeds of print out.
And that's human error as well that can happen so easily.
Definitely. So, one car which came up was a red Ford Corsair, the registered owner of which was Peter Sutcliffe, who lived in Heaton, Bradford. His car had come up seven times in Leeds and Bradford. Peter Sutcliffe was interviewed for the third time by police in August 1978, and he was asked about travelling to the red light areas. He claimed he was on his way to work at the time that he was seen, and his wife corroborated that they rarely went out at night. In April 1979, Josephine Whittaker, was a 19-year-old young lady who worked in a building society. She was walking home from her grandmother's house late one night. She was attacked at Savile Park in Halifax, which was known to be a nice area. Josephine had been bitten, and it was determined the perpetrator had a gap between his front two teeth. Shoe prints were also found at the scene, size 7, and the right shoe was determined to be more worn than the left.
Traces of engineering oil had been found in some of the 25 stab wounds on Josephine's body, leading police to believe the killer had worked with the substance.
Tape was then received by police addressed to George Oldfield and claiming to be from the Ripper. The tape was made public on the 26th of June 1979 in an attempt to help trace the man. The man speaking on the tape had a Sunderland accent and prompted more than 50,000 calls to the police upon its publication. In it, the man claimed the police were no closer to catching him. Stanley Ellis from Leeds University was brought in to analyse the tape. He felt that the man had an accent originating from Castletown in Sunderland. Now, Castletown is on the northeast coast of England in Tyne and Wear and had a population of only 5,000 at the time. Northumbria police set up camp there and played the tape through speakers on a continual loop so the public could hear it. Despite their efforts, no one identified the caller. A year had been spent checking vehicles in red light areas, and a black Sunbeam rapier had been seen twice in Leeds, once in Manchester, and 36 times in Bradford. The registered keeper of the car was Peter Sutcliffe.
So is this a new car he's got then? Has he switched cars? Right, okay.
Yeah. So 36 times it had been seen in the red light areas in Bradford, so, you know, that's not insignificant. So in July 1979, a constable named Andrew Lapchew was sent to question Peter Sutcliffe about the number of times his car had been seen in red light areas.
Mm.
At the time, Sutcliffe was 33 years old, and the PC was struck by how closely he resembled the effect given by Marilyn Moore. Marilyn Moore was the woman who survived, the one that had the glancing blow to the side of her head. So the effect that she had produced was really detailed, and he was struck by how similar this man looked to that effit. His shoe size matched, and the constable noted that he had a gap between his front two teeth. There were other concerns as well, how often he'd been seen in the red light areas, etc. So the PC submitted a report highlighting his concerns about Sutcliffe, but it was passed over by the senior investigating officer, Dick Holland, due to him not having a Sunderland accent and having different handwriting to the letters. So Peter Sutcliffe was obviously, he was from Bradford, he had a Bradford accent, but because this tape that had been received, you know, along with letters purporting to be from the Ripper, because he had a Sunderland accent, which is a completely different accent to Bradford, and because his handwriting was different, he was ruled out.
The thing is, nowadays we know that people try to insert themselves in the investigation, and it happens a lot that these are trolls, or there are people that just want a bit of attention, or people nowadays have actually been sent to prison for doing this and perverting the course of justice by inserting themselves. Yeah. So they wouldn't take it as gospel, you know, when someone said, oh, it's me, I'm the murderer. Nowadays they wouldn't be so quick to accept it, I wouldn't have thought.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think from our point of view, it's hard to understand why somebody would want to assume responsibility for something like this. But people have their reasons, whatever they may be. There are apparently a lot of people that call in to try and claim responsibility for crimes, which, I mean, it baffles me, but it is a significant problem. So the senior investigating officer, Dick Holland, because this man didn't have the Sunderland accent and his handwriting were different, he was ruled out. And basically, I understand as well that at the time, they sort of took the approach, look, if they don't have a Sunderland accent, just rule them out. Just, you know, they were trying to do as much as they could to just narrow down. Because I would imagine just the wealth of information in Leeds and, you know, Leeds inquiries that they had going on, they would just be overwhelmed, basically, and trying to...
So they're fixated on that aspect as being a given. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's to me, it's completely understandable for the time. The police essentially tipped Sutcliffe off, and the result was that he stopped trawling red light areas. On the 1st of September 1979, Barbara Leach was a 20-year-old student who was walking home from the pub, close to her university in Bradford. She was struck in the head with a hammer and stabbed 8 times. Her body was hidden beneath some steps and she was covered with rubbish and an old carpet. Then a police officer raised doubts about the letters being from the killer. It was originally believed that they contained only information that could have been known by the killer. One of those pieces of information was the fact that Vera Millward had been a patient at Manchester Royal Infirmary. That's the one that had died on the grounds of the Manchester Royal Infirmary. Well, she'd also been a patient there. So that was a piece of information that the police believed that only the killer could know. However, it was found that a Daily Mail article published prior to receiving the letter from the Ripper did actually state that fact. And I believe that there were other things that came into question that sort of really kind of pulled the whole theory apart about the letters being genuine. Then, the person who wrote the letters actually called in to police and confirmed that they'd been a hoax. Now, the person that took the call said they knew the accent, they knew the voice better than they knew their own voice because the tape had been played on a loop constantly. You know, members of the public would call into the incident room and ask to hear the tape. So they were keen to publicise it as much as possible in order to try and identify this guy. So people knew it really, really well. And the man from Leeds University who'd analysed the accent, the dialect, explained why he felt that it was for a Castletown accent and Sunderland and, you know, all the sort of nuances in the way he spoke and things. So the man who took the call from the person who claimed to be the letter writer, he says he knew straight off the bat that it was him because he'd heard his voice over and over and over again. So he believed the call to be genuine, but again, it was just lost. It was just lost within all the other data that they were receiving and wasn't really taken very seriously. So I think at this point...
That makes more sense, though. That makes more sense that he would have done both the letter and the tapes.
Yeah.
So presumably that person did the murder that wasn't linked then. Is that...
Well,
assumption,
I'm not sure.
Because you know how they said, you said that the saliva was linked to the blood type that matched?
Blood group.
Okay.
Yeah, blood group. So, I mean, B positive, which was only 6% of the population at the time, but that was as narrow as it got, I think, in terms of tie-in.
Just find it interesting that he linked that murder and highlighted it as,
yes.
Oh, you know, you've missed yeah. This one, and then his blood group is the same as the perpetrator of that.
Yeah, I don't know a huge amount about that, but the letter was received before Vera Millward's murder, and Vera Millward was 41. And in the letter, they actually stated, I think it was something along the lines of, it'll be an old bag next. So a lot of the victims had been young, although the age of the victims did vary, but Vera Millward was 41, so the next victim was an older victim. So that was another reason that gave police to believe he was the culprit. So it's understandable. So, as I say, he called in to basically confess that it had been a hoax, but it wasn't taken seriously and just lost. Lost within all the other data that they'd been collecting at that time. So the line of inquiry regarding the £5 note, the new £5 note that had been given to Jean Jordan, that was reignited at that point. I don't know if that was because doubts and questions had started to be raised in regards to these letters and whether this person was responsible, but anyway, this line of inquiry was revitalised, basically.
Yeah.
But this time, police made a breakthrough. The number of employees who could have possibly received the note was narrowed down from 8,000 to 241.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is very impressive. Bear in mind, this was 1979, so it's pretty good. Among the 241 was Peter Sutcliffe, a lorry driver from Bradford. In January 1980, Sutcliffe was interviewed for the 7th, 8th and 9th time. So Barbara's murder was in September. They made the breakthrough with a £5 note. And he was interviewed in January 1980. So then there's a bit of a gap. And it's funny because you can see the pattern. Every time after he's questioned, there's a longer gap than there had been at other points. At other points, you could go maybe 1, 2, you know, 3 months without a murder. Well, nothing happened until August 1980.
So it shows you that he can control himself then.
But I mean, this is almost a whole year. You've gone from 1st of September 1979 and then the next victim's on the 20th of August 1980. So yeah, there's an element of control there. So on the 20th of August 1980, Marguerite Walls was a 47-year-old civil servant from Leeds who was attacked as she walked home. She was hit on the head and strangled with a piece of cord. Her clothes had been removed and she was sexually assaulted. Her body was hidden under a pile of freshly cut grass in the grounds of a large house. Her attack was not originally thought to have been committed by the Ripper due to the fact that she'd been strangled, because that wasn't his normal method. It was normally hit over the head and stabbed. That was usually what happened, but she'd been strangled, so they didn't initially include that in the series.
In September 1980, 34-year-old Dr. Upadhyay Bhandara was making her way home after visiting friends. As she took a shortcut via an alleyway, she was hit in the head from behind with a hammer. A ligature was placed around her neck while her shoes and handbag were moved further away. Her attacker was spooked upon hearing someone nearby and fled, leaving Dr. Bhandara bleeding heavily. She survived the attack.
In November 1980, 16-year-old Teresa Sykes left her boyfriend and baby at home and walked to the shops nearby to buy cigarettes. On her way home, within sight of her house, like literally a stone's throw from her house, she was attacked and sustained 3 hammer blows to the head. Her neighbour disturbed her attacker and he took off. The neighbour took her into their house. Police were quick to arrive on the scene and they brought sniffer dogs. The dogs did pick up a scent, but the perpetrator escaped. Teresa survived the attack. On the 17th of November 1980, 20-year-old Jacqueline Hill was a student from Leeds who was on her way home from night school when she was attacked. She was bludgeoned in the head with a hammer, her body exposed and stabbed. Thankfully, but not before time, Jacqueline was the last victim to be killed by the Ripper. His first and last victims were killed just over 5 years apart. Professor Stuart Kind, a forensic scientist, plotted the times, dates and locations of the attacks and came up with a theory that the perpetrator lived in either Manningham or Shipley. Both are in Bradford, approximately 3 miles apart. Guess what? Peter Sutcliffe lived between those two locations. In December 1980, Sutcliffe stole registration plates from a breaker's yard in Huddersfield. So in December 1980, he stole some registration plates from the breakers in Huddersfield. On 2nd of January 1981, 2 police officers were on night patrol in Sheffield. They approached a rover which contained a man and a woman, clearly what appeared to be a sex worker with a client. On checking the registration of the car, it was found to belong to a Skoda. So obviously the plates belonged to a Skoda, but the car is a Rover, so they knew that they were stolen, basically, or false. The man was arrested but claimed he had to urinate, and so he was allowed to relieve himself nearby next to an oil container. Now, after he was taken into custody and after discovering screwdrivers in the glove compartment of the car, the officers returned to the scene the next day. At the place where the man had relieved himself, they found a hammer and a knife. The sex worker who had been in the car was Olivia Reaver, who was aged 24. The man in custody was none other than Peter Sutcliffe. He'd given false details when he was arrested, but they obviously eventually found out who he was. He eventually confessed to murdering 13 women and attacking another 7. So that's 20 victims. Peter Sutcliffe was the oldest of 6 children from a Catholic mill worker's family in Bingley, West Yorkshire. Some reports say his childhood was unremarkable, but others describe his father as a monster. Some reports also suggest he was very clingy with his mother and an insecure child. As a young man, Sutcliffe spent a year working as a gravedigger in Bingley. It was at this point he claims his killer instincts were born. There were also reports that he claimed to have heard the voice of God during the time that he did this job, and that he should rid the world of prostitutes, which people were a bit dubious as to whether the claim was real or if he was just trying to claim some sort of insanity at the time.
Yeah, he was trying to get away with it somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
And what about the women that weren't sex workers then?
Yeah, exactly. When Peter Sutcliffe's blood was tested, he was found to be B negative, and therefore of a different blood group to Joan Harrison's killer. On the 22nd of May 1981, Peter Sutcliffe was found guilty of the murder of the 13 women by a majority verdict and of the attempted murder of the other seven. He received 20 life sentences. In 2010, a whole of life order was placed on him, deeming that he would never be released from prison. After 3 years in Parkhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and sent to Broadmoor Secure Hospital. Sutcliffe spent 3 decades at Broadmoor Hospital before being moved to HMP Frankland in County Durham in 2016, after a health tribunal determined he no longer required treatment for a mental disorder. He died in hospital on Friday, 13th of November, aged 74, after refusing treatment for COVID-19. In 2005, John Humble was found to be Wearside Jack, the man who played the hoax on police pretending to be the Ripper. A quote from an article in the Northern Echo dated 13th of November 2020 states, "In the following months and years, he tried to kill himself, once jumping from a bridge over the Weir. He became an alcoholic and remained undetected until a cold case review in 2005 matched DNA from saliva on an envelope to a sample he gave following an arrest for being drunk and disorderly. He was jailed in 2006 for 8 years for perverting the course of justice and drank himself to death in 2019. It emerged that Humble had a grudge against police as a youth and an interest in the Jack the Ripper story. But he had felt guilt when the Ripper continued to kill after the tape arrived, telling police, 'I blamed myself for it, that's why I phoned in.' They took no notice and another two got killed. John Humble died in 2019, aged 63. And that is the case of the Yorkshire Ripper. Do you have any questions for me?
No, I just think that there's one good thing come out of 2020, at least.
Yeah.
I am a little confused, though, because I didn't know that you could have paranoid schizophrenia and then it just magically goes away. I thought that was a whole-of-life condition. So I wonder if maybe it was managed with medication and that's why they were saying... You know how they said that he no longer needed treatment for the mental condition? I just find it odd that they suddenly decided that he was no longer a paranoid schizophrenic.
Yeah, I mean, I read it as he's been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic and it's been managed with medication successfully.
Yeah.
Therefore, he doesn't need to be in a health facility.
But then, was that not after 2 decades?
3.
3 decades, yeah. I mean,
30 years.
Do you know what I mean? See, if it'd been a couple of years of treatment and then they go, oh, well, actually, we feel that we've got it under control.
Yeah.
It just seemed odd, that was all. It was just something that stuck out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if he... You know, I think the... I'm just totally guessing here. But what we know about mental health conditions has come a long way. So at the time, I wouldn't imagine that he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, per se. I would imagine that he was probably deemed insane. You know, or something along those lines. And then actually, as time has progressed, they're like, do you know, he actually maybe has a mild form of paranoid schizophrenia, whatever.
Mm, okay, yeah.
Well, actually, it did say as a result of a health tribunal. So I wonder, I didn't look into what the grounds of that were or how that came about or who prompted that tribunal, but it was on the back of that that he was transferred to a prison.
Totally, yeah. It's been reviewed somewhere along the line, yeah.
So he pleaded guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility, but it was rejected.
Mm.
So when he was first convicted, he went to Parkhurst Prison in the Isle of Wight. So he was in prison for the first 3 years. It was only after the first 3 years that he'd been diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic or whatever it was that he was diagnosed at that time. And then he was transferred to Broadmoor.
It's all so interesting because he was never allowed to be freed. So they obviously didn't deem him not culpable for committing those attacks. You know, they have held him responsible for them, regardless of his mental state. The thing is, also with paranoid schizophrenia, people that suffer from it can often have problems with impulse control, and, you know, the attacks that happen as a result of that are generally not well planned out, and sometimes it can be really hard.
Frenzied.
Yeah, and it's hard for someone to maintain a quote-unquote normal life.
Normal life, yeah, so I agree.
That, and the fact that, like we were saying before, the fact that after the police interviewed him, he would lay low, shows that there's an element of control there and an understanding that what he was doing was
wrong.
Yeah,
cognitive awareness.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
He knows what he's doing is wrong.
Yeah.
So I was find it really interesting, that kind of just looking at it from a theoretical point of view, morality,
yes.
You know, it really feels like he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, it is very interesting from a psychological point of view, because when I read that he'd been diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, I was like, that's, you know, that's not the impression that I got throughout, for the reasons that you've mentioned. The large basis of my research came from an old documentary on the Yorkshire Ripper, because it was so detailed. It was a really good basis for the research for this episode.
What was it called? Would anyone like it to watch it? Yeah,
it's on YouTube, but I mean, it is a bit dated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not completely up to date, because obviously at that point nothing was known about Wearside Jack. He hadn't been caught, so there was no more information about him. Manhunt: The Search for the Yorkshire Ripper. That's the name of the documentary. It's on YouTube. It came out in 1999. For anyone who is interested in watching a documentary on the Yorkshire Ripper, BBC did a 3-part series last year, which is airing on TV again in the UK on the 8th of December. The Netflix documentary on the Yorkshire Ripper will be available on the 16th of December. And ITV are also working on a documentary for UK television, which I think is going to be a 6-part series, but I believe no date has been confirmed for that as yet. So that's why I used this documentary as the basis, because it was so detailed.
Has his spouse, has she been given like a name change or anything like that?
She still lives in the home that she shared with Pierce Utcliffe.
That's bizarre, isn't it?
Our listeners will be able to check the sources for the research in our show notes. So the good thing is that although there are not many sources stated, some of the sources that are there are really extensive. But one of the websites gives a lot of information. And it's quite interesting. If people want to do a bit of reading about Peter Sutcliffe's wife and their life before he was found guilty. So the website is called yorkshireripper.com. And it has a lot of information on it. There's articles there, pictures of him, articles from the time when they were searching for him. There's a lot in there. But included in that is information on his life and the relationship that he had with his wife and family. So there was a lot more to read up on it. If you're interested, I think it'd be worth it. There'll be books as well. But the relationship, from what I gathered from that website, between him and his wife was very strange. And I believe she also spent some time in a psychiatric facility. She had her own psychiatric issues. But yeah, a very strange relationship.
Thank you very much. I really, once again, I always hate saying I enjoyed it, but...
Enjoyed it,
yeah. I found that very interesting.
Because there was 20 victims, and this is kind of the thing that I want to point out. Obviously, a lot of the recent articles on the case are talking about the fact that he died, and there's a brief summary of his crimes and things. But kind of the galling thing for me was the fact that a lot of the articles just seemed to outline the 13 women that were murdered, which is fair enough. You know, they need to be remembered, and it should be. It should be more about the victims than the perpetrator. However, there were still 7 women that were attacked and survived. And not only that, you know, we're not just talking about, you know, something insignificant. We're talking about significant attacks, life-changing. And I just kind of feel that if I was one of the victims that had survived, and every time these articles came up regurgitating the information that really only highlighted the 13 women that passed away as a result, I think I'd probably feel a little bit pissed off.
Yeah, I get that. I think also I probably would just hate the fact that it was a reminder generally of him. And yeah, as we know, especially with serial killers, they kind of get glamorized and it all becomes a bit
about them.
Yeah, it becomes about them and it becomes a bit of a media show. And
yeah,
like you said, life changing. I was just thinking how traumatic it would be. Like the young girl that walked just to get some cigarettes and left her boyfriend and a baby, and she's just outside her own door. And like, you wouldn't want to live in that house. You wouldn't want to walk down the street. You wouldn't want to go to the corner shop by yourself. You wouldn't trust anyone.
No. And that's the thing. So she was 16 years old at the time. She had a baby. You know, so she's just become a mother. She's a young mother. She's, you know, and she's, to me, still a child herself at that point, you know, still got a lot to learn and, you know, a lot of life to live. So that's really significant. She's just become a mother. So she's just experiencing motherhood. And then to go through something as traumatic as that, to survive it and have to live with that for the rest of her life. She was actually on the documentary. She featured in the documentary, it was just so sad.
I was going to say, for some of them, that could lead to like long-term brain damage issues, sensory issues, obviously trauma, PTSD. It really could affect your whole entire life.
Without a doubt. If not just psychologically, potentially physically as well.
Absolutely.
And Marcella Claxton, the one who was originally not believed to be a Ripper victim because she wasn't a sex worker. She was 20 at the time and she was 4 months pregnant. She lost her baby as a result of that attack. And she came around, she was covered in blood, she staggered to a phone box, she managed to call the police. You know, how difficult would it be to move past that and, you know, try to move on with your life?
Yeah, I think it depends on the type of person you're as well, because, you know, for anyone that loses a child, it's never going to be something that's easy to process. But for some people, unfortunately, it does follow them throughout their entire lives and it's always something that's with them. So I just, you know, you do hear stories for people and it's horrific. It's horrific to happen to anyone for whatever reason, but especially as a result of something like that. It's just awful. Really sad. Really, really sad.
I completely agree. And I mean, another thing that's covered in the documentary, which is also very interesting, was just detailing the you know, the investigation and how sort of significant and overwhelming it was, you know, for West Yorkshire Police. Everything that was involved, the amount of man hours put into it, but then also the questions raised and the sort of the actions taken on the back of it after he'd been caught. I mean, George Oldfield, who the letters had been addressed to by Wearside Jack, 4 years after his retirement, he died, and they believe that it essentially contributed to him going into an early grave, essentially, because he bore the weight of the investigation on his shoulders like a personal responsibility. And that's the thing, it's very easy for people to come in after the fact and say this was done wrong, that was done wrong, and point fingers. But when you're living through that and you're having to learn as you go, I mean, you know, this was Britain's biggest manhunt at the time. They probably never had an investigation of this size. You know, it would be a fly by the seat of your pants, learn as you go along kind of situation. It's not like you probably had, you know, several other significant investigations of this magnitude that you could just put that template or process in place and crack on with it. So it's understandable that mistakes were made. It's understandable why they believed that the letters were from the culprit. And I mean, the problem was that I think what probably contributed to it is, as you say, you see the bias coming in because a lot of the victims were sex workers. And it's disgusting to say, but there will have been an attitude at the time where some people would just say, oh, well, you know, the dregs of society kind of thing. And for me, it was only really because Marcella Claxton, although she wasn't a sex worker, because she wasn't included in the series at the time, her one wasn't really taken seriously. It was only at the point where Jane McDonald was attacked, you know, the 16-year-old shop assistant that was found in the children's playground, that they actually sat up and went, but she was a pretty young woman. She wasn't a sex worker. Oh, wow. You know, suddenly he's given a moniker. Suddenly people pay attention and, you know, more public interest comes around. And You know, it's just sad. But also, another thing that I read during the research was somebody had stated, I can't remember exactly who it was, actually, at the time that the investigation was done, all the reporters were male.
Yeah.
All the police officers were male. There was no real, like, gender mix in the police force. It was predominantly a male environment, male reporters, and they had their own prejudices at that time. And they said, you know, we didn't really feel that we were represented as females.
Even up until the 90s and early noughties, though, different police forces still used to arrest sex workers.
Yeah.
And, you know, they wouldn't have a good reputation with them, a good relationship with them. There certainly wasn't the trust in the police that in certain parts of the world, thankfully, now some sex workers are able to feel that they could go to the police.
Yeah.
So it's just a really difficult one. But yeah, I think there's a lot of issues surrounding people ignoring things that happen to people just because they aren't like them.
Yeah.
And until it was someone that reminded them of their daughter or their niece or whatever, that brought it home and it was like, oh shit, this can happen to us. This can happen to any of us. It's not just because, you know, it's that kind of like other, it's the sex workers are not like us, so they put themselves in these situations, you know, that kind of nonsense.
Although there would be a lot of victim blaming.
Yeah, and it's really, really shocking. So yeah, it is really sad that even to this day and age we still see it for different demographics. There are demographics which are underrepresented in proportion to crimes that are actually perpetrated against them, and we still see it today. Some cases are much higher profile than others. What is it, the blonde white woman syndrome, you know? Yeah,
blue hair blonde eyes, blue hair.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, though.
Yeah,
white totally. White girl with, yeah, so, you know, blonde hair gone missing, everybody sit up, pay attention, all guns blazing, all alerts out, sirens blaring. But yeah, take someone from a minority and there's just not the same reaction. Let's be honest, there's not.
No. And it's a bit like even when we were saying about the Reese Bonner case, you know, if a young woman had been found like he was, half naked, dead, submerged in marshland, in my mind, pretty suspicious circumstances, I think there would have been a different response if it had been a young woman.
Yeah, especially if the police had made the same conclusion, mm-hmm, that he'd just taken drugs, yeah, and it just died as a result, basically. And yeah, absolutely, they would be outraged. And it's mm-hmm unequal that it's not treated the same because he was a boy. Even just the fact that question of drugs being involved there, again, it's just that prejudice. Someone can take a legal high, for example, and doesn't mean that if they end up dying just because they have that legal, yeah, high in their system, it's their fault, or mm-hmm, they've contributed to it in some way. It's such a victim blaming attitude, and it's just so wrong.
And people can get attacked and murdered whilst under the influence of things. So
exactly,
it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's killed.
Yeah, them. You just go, well, drugs, so case closed, job done.
Really, really frustrating.
Absolutely. So yeah, so I don't know if you have an interesting or funny true crime related, yeah, fact or story for us.
This is another one that I found. It's a story and it was also reminded me of you.
Okay.
So once again, I have included an animal, well, a bird, and food into the true crime story that I found. I mean, it's like these ones are just written for me. You might have actually seen a video of this. I think the video went on the rounds online. So this was in 2007. And this is from a BBC News article. A seagull has turned shoplifter by wandering into a shop and helping itself to crisps.
Seen the video.
Yep. If you haven't seen it, you need to see this. It's amazing.
Is it a Greg walks?
It's an RS McCall.
Oh, and right.
It's a news agent in Aberdeen, and the doors open and he goes in and he steals some cheese flavoured Doritos. And they call him Sam, so they've given him a nickname, and he was really popular that the locals started paying for the crisps because I remember
that's on, so nice.
It was on the news. I know it was on the news, and I remember that the shop assistant and we're like, I mean, it's a little bit annoying because we're losing stock and we're losing money, but it's kind of funny, but it's actually still a little bit annoying.
Yeah.
And it was only the cheese Doritos that he kept stealing.
That's hilarious.
Which is really weird. I don't know if that was, maybe they were the most accessible, maybe they were lower down.
Or... I was just about to say, maybe they were closest to the door.
Apparently at the time they were 55 pence, so I mean, he's not got, you know, he wasn't going for Space Raiders. He wanted something a bit higher.
But then he's also not going for Walker Sensations, so...
That's true.
Yeah.
And he's not going low fat. He knows he's going to need those calories for flying and, you know, pecking people, stealing chips, all the rest of it. So once outside, they'd ripped the crisps open and he shared them with some of his friends.
Yeah, they do.
So the guy at the shop assistant, Sriraram Nagarajan, said, "He's got it down to a fine art. He waits until there are no customers around and I'm standing behind the till. Then he raids the place." At first, I didn't believe a seagull even was capable of stealing crisps, but I saw it with my own eyes and I was surprised. He's very good at it. He's becoming a bit of a celebrity. Seagulls are usually not that popular, but Sam is a star because he's so funny. So cute. I love it.
That's amazing.
So yeah, and then they actually got a spokesman from the RSPB Scotland, who said, "I've never heard anything like this before. Perhaps it tried some crisps in a shiny packet in the street and was just opportunistic one day at the shop when it saw what was inside. Yeah. As everyone knows, gulls can be very quick and fearless, and clearly this one is no exception." He added, "We discourage people from feeding gulls, though, as gulls in towns generate lots of complaints every year and the availability of food is the only reason they live in urban settings."
Yes. So I'm going to have to make a comment here because you know what I'm like about seagulls. So seagulls are massively misunderstood.
I love them.
And actually, yes, they are. Do you know what? They are actually wonderful creatures. They live for... I think it's known that they live for sort of 20, 30 years.
He might still be kicking about then. That was 2007.
I believe that from about the age of 4 is when they get the orange spot on their beak. The babies are obviously brown. You see they have the brown and white flecks. However, being that I volunteer with a wildlife rescue group, I am one of these people that is for feeding seagulls. And here's my reason and why. Because... seagulls don't attack you and steal food because they want to. They do it because they're starving, right? So sometimes you'll see baby gulls, chicks, they have a wing deformity where both wings hang down at a strange angle. It's called angel wing, right? And they believe that that deformity happens as a result of malnutrition. Because the thing is that the oceans are overfished and we build into areas where they live, you know, in the colonies and things. So for me, I feel that we do have a responsibility to replace their food source because that's just the way I am. And also, I have seagulls outside. Because I live by the coast, obviously there are lots of seagulls. Before I started feeding my seagulls, we have workers a building across the road. And every lunchtime when they come out to sit on the wall and eat their lunch, they would get hounded by the gulls begging them for food. Right, at their feet, sitting on their vans, squawking at them, which results in them having to go and sit inside their vans to eat their lunch because they're being hounded so much. However, when I started feeding them in the morning and the afternoon, guess what? All that stopped. So anybody that was walking up and down my street that was getting hounded for food doesn't happen anymore. And also, they're quite good because they will have sort of territories and there's a bit of a pecking order and they have an understanding.
A pecking order?
Yeah. And
pecking order.
from observing them, you can see that they will call the other gulls to tell them that there's food, but there's a hierarchy, definitely. And if I put food out and my two, Peter and Penelope, aren't there, the other gulls, listen to this, the other gulls will not land and they will not touch that food.
How weird.
So there you go. And I bet people would not think that would be the case, but it is.
You'd think they'd all be at
That's it. So Peter and Penelope, this is their patch. They call me for food. When I put food out, the others come, they eat. But if they're not there and I chuck food out, they won't touch it.
You have pet seagulls.
I do.
It's amazing.
And they're incredibly intelligent as well.
What do you feed them?
Cat biscuits.
Okay.
They love cat biscuits. So cat biscuits, you can soak them in a little bit of water. And cat biscuits are easy to chuck in a box and put in your backpack to go out and about. Also, another good thing to feed them as a treat is seafood sticks.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like crab sticks.
Yes. So the reason I feed them that is because I want to counteract this malnutrition that leads to angel wing in chicks, because unfortunately, if it's not caught early, there's nothing they can do. It's essentially the wrist joint in a seagull, and if it's not caught early and fixed, the seagull can't survive because they can't fly.
So they can't fly.
So they get put down. And it's as a result of malnutrition. So that's why I feed them, because I feed them fishy cat biscuits, because it's nutritional for them, it's good. So there you go.
Whereas when I was a student in Aberdeen, I used to drunkenly feed them chips.
Chips. Well, they love chips. They do. Chips. They absolutely love chips. But the problem is, it's like when people are warned not to feed ducks, you know, at ponds, they say, please don't feed the ducks bread. And the reason being that, because it's not their natural diet, it leads to so many problems because it's not nutritious. But you can buy duck and swan food, which is similar to cat biscuits.
Yeah, they do look like that, yeah.
And you can sprinkle it. But that's the reason why people stopped, they asked people to stop feeding the ducks, because it just causes so many problems. But then the problem with that is that they end up starving. They go hungry because people aren't feeding them anymore. So you can be sensible about it. You can feed them in public areas like parks and things like that. Feed them nutritious. Try not to feed them bread and chips. Try to, you know, do that occasionally. They like a treat. But please do help our wildlife, because if a gull lives for 30 years, that's a long time to be scavenging for food.
It is. It's a bit sad, isn't it?
It is. And they do. They are actually wonderful creatures.
I love them. I think they're really funny.
They are. They're hilarious.
They're so funny.
They're very funny.
I love that you've got pet ones. That just makes my day. For our listeners, I think that we should put Peter and Penelope, I think you should put a picture. Oh God, this is like a tongue twister. We should put a picture of Peter and Penelope on the Instagram for people.
Yeah, I can absolutely do that.
You can maybe Photoshop in like a little outfit for them or something. You've been listening to Murder, She Spoke. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider going to your podcast platform of choice and leaving us a 5-star rating and or a review. If you want to get in contact with us, we have an email address. It's info@murdershespoke.net, and we are also on social media. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and on Facebook. Thank you so much. We'll see you in a week.
Feed the birds.